Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
Hello, listeners. Today is Thursday, January 11th. 2018. I'm your host, Charlie Mattesian, sitting in for our regular host, Scott Bland, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We've got a jam-packed show ahead of this week with so much news to talk about that we probably won't even get to that crazy video of our new ambassador to the Netherlands getting grilled by the Dutch press. But what we will get to is President Trump's televised immigration meeting. Could it mean significant changes to DACA and immigration reform come from that discussion? Or was it just an optics play? We'll also discuss a massive 200-page Russia report released by the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And finally, because you know we had to, we are going to have a discussion about how the Me Too movement is continuing to shake up Congress and Hollywood, and especially in the form of Oprah Winfrey's prospective presidential bid. Before we get started, a reminder. Please subscribe to the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening app. Rate us and write a review. Joining us today is a Nerdcast rookie, Alana Shore, who we're thrilled to have here from our Congress team. Hi, Alana.
Hey there.
We're also here with a Nerdcast veteran, rockstar White House reporter Annie Carney. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Charlie.
Our first data point today is the number 55. That's the number of minutes that television cameras were rolling while the president discussed immigration reform and DACA with congressional leaders on Tuesday. And when I say DACA, I mean Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Now, during that 55 minutes of prime political theater, President Trump seemed intent on making a deal with the members in that room, and so much so that he actually appeared to confuse some of his own policy positions at times, and most notably when California Senator Dianne Feinstein proposed a so-called clean DACA bill, which is most definitely not what Republicans want, since they want additional security or other reforms attached to the measure.
What about a clean DACA bill now, with a commitment that we go into a comprehensive immigration reform procedure?
I have no problem. I think that's basically what Dick is saying. We're going to come out with DACA. We're going to do DACA. And then we can start immediately on the phase two, which would be comprehensive.
Would you be agreeable to that?
Yeah, I would like to do it. Go ahead. I think a lot of people would like to see that.
So why don't we start with you, Annie? In our newsroom, at least, that whole scene was must-see TV. What was that spectacle all about? Why was the entire event televised? It felt like the optics and the theater of that moment were just as important as the policy discussion itself.
Yes, I think Trump, even in welcoming the press into the room, said like "Welcome to the stage" or something. This was a Trump show, and it comes on the heels of the Michael Wolff book that has reopened a question about his mental fitness for office and his ability to just actually get through the day and do the job. It comes as Axios has reported that he has, quote unquote, executive time, which means he doesn't actually get to the office till 11 because he's at home tweeting and watching TV in the morning. Executive time, leaves the office at 6. So this was widely interpreted as the White House saying, we'll let you watch Trump hold a meeting with Congress and look presidential and put together coherent sentences and show you like there's another side to him that's missing in this whole conversation. So that's what they were trying to do there. And to some extent, it was a success. He showed no mastery of policy, and he got confused about he had to be corrected by Republican lawmakers not to agree with Feinstein in that exchange you just cited. He didn't show real mastery of policy skills, but he showed he didn't interrupt anyone. He didn't say anything crazy. There was no, didn't call anyone a name. It was basically a fine performance if you're judging him by a rather low bar. So I'd say it was the White House considered it a success.
Well, that threshold is really low, use those standards. But then it kind of suggested to me, watching from afar, that The president is maybe less committed to a hardline position on immigration than candidate Trump, for whom build the wall was the leading chant. I mean, what are we to take from his statements on the bill? Okay, so it was a lot of theater, but did we learn anything about where he stands and what exactly he demands out of the final bill?
I don't think he demands anything out of the final bill. I think he's very open to just signing something that lands on his desk. And we've seen him waffle, especially on DACA, a few times. Like, think back to September during the heyday of his Chuck and Nancy relationship, where he seemed to have them over for a Chinese dinner and agree to DACA with no wall, and then kind of walked it back in the next days. He, on every issue, seems to be more interested in just having a win, having something to sign, than being really committed to any of the details. The wall is a little different because it is such it was literally a campaign chant. But I think that the discussion around, they'll still say that we're going to do the wall. And whatever border security measures they agree to, they'll still keep talking about the wall. It'll continue to be a talking point. But I don't think that Trump, especially, I mean, he has expressed sympathy for the students and children affected by DACA. I think he doesn't have a hard line position when it comes to DACA that he will absolutely stick to.
Alana, I'm going to reveal my shallowness here and say that part of that event, part of the theater that I loved, was watching the members of Congress sort of scramble to respond to the president. Whether it was Kevin McCarthy from California, sort of scrambling to save the president when the president appeared to commit to Feinstein's position, but also watching the Democrats, watching the discomfort of Dick Durbin sitting next to the president as the president talked, and you could almost, I was sort of playing in my own head what he was thinking in his own head. Oh, please don't let them bring a photograph. What facial expression should I have? Could this haunt me in a primary, or is the Democratic caucus going to be angry with me? But the mood on Capitol Hill after this, the response on Capitol Hill on this, what did it change anything? Was it unexpected? I mean, tell us about the view from the other side.
Well, it changed some things on the margins symbolically, but the substance of it was fairly meager when it comes to what Congress is working on. The good thing was folks walked out of that meeting with a clear sense of what was being negotiated on. And I would say that sense came after the cameras stopped running, not from the theater that we all saw on TV. So they know now that they're discussing four main issues, right, which is dealing with DACA, chain migration, the visa lottery system, and what we call a TPS, temporary protected status. Now, that's all a lot of nerdery. But what it comes down to is at least now they know what they're talking about. And, you know, even this morning, Senator Jeff Flake was saying to reporters outside a hearing that we could see a deal emerge as soon as today. So in that sense, it helped grease the gears forward a little bit. But, you know, symbolically, it if anything, I think just hardened the way that the right and the left on Capitol Hill is viewing these negotiations. Democrats are really, really worried that what's going to come out is going to be too watered down, too much, you know, interior enforcement that threatens immigrant families for them to support. And Republicans are worried, you know, just about having DACA in here at all, which smacks of amnesty to some conservative activists. So in that sense, the meeting really didn't change anything and sent people back to their corners.
So if there is evidence maybe of or signs of a potential revolt within the Democratic caucus as they edge toward a deal, how big is the size of that resistance within the Democratic caucus in the House? Like, are we talking about the majority? Are we talking about a significant number? I mean, can you put some flesh that out a little?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the House, the resistance is bigger just because you have the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which is a pretty influential bloc in there that has been skeptical of this entire exercise from the start. In the Senate, it's a smaller pool of liberal members. You know, your Kamala Harris's, your Kirsten Gillibrand's, your Cory Booker's, the folks who back in 2017 said we're not even voting for a stopgap spending bill without talking about DACA, those are the ones who are probably going to dig in their heels against anything that's perceived as giving away too much to Trump. But the key here, though, Charlie, is that just because there aren't necessarily enough votes to kill it on the Democratic side doesn't mean it's not threatening to the entire exercise because you're losing so many conservatives. So, you know, much as we see with just these spending votes, it's a matter of getting that math right losing enough, just enough Dems and just enough conservatives to pass something.
And what are the camps on the Republican side? Like, how would you roughly divide them? How would you describe those camps?
Well, I mean, the most important camp, I think, is going to be the camp of hardliners who just say no. And that could be anywhere from, you know, five conservative senators and, you know, half of the House Freedom Caucus to like the whole House Freedom Caucus, depending on what a final deal looks like. And there's the rub, really, politically for leaders.
And hardliners want a wall, right? Is that the case?
They do want a wall. I mean, the unspoken thing up there in the Capitol these days is like Democrats know that even if it's border security, the administration is going to market it as a wall. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be hard to get around that because per Annie's point, they just love to talk about the wall. They'll call anything the wall.
I've heard – I was talking to like Republican operatives outside the White House who are supportive of the Trump administration who said like that's just regular Washington deal making, like agreeing to some security measures. And the Democrats say it's not a wall and the Trump White House will say it's a wall. And that's how you get things done. Like, and you agree to disagree about the terminology and everyone can claim a win. That's how it,
that would be the best case scenario, right? Like if this thing passes, and it's going to be what's in a wall? Define a wall.
And I guess that's going to be the sort of the defining image for the 2018 campaign as well. Every campaign commercial is going to have to address the wall issue, whether it's, you know, sort of a visual of a wall or something that suggests that the Republican majority delivered for its constituents, which I guess is that what we're seeing out of the polls too, that Republicans know that their voters are demanding a wall? Or do they expect a wall?
Again, I think it's all in how you define a wall.
Right.
I don't think the majority of voters are that tuned in to the nuance, so to speak. I mean, even Bernie Sanders told me earlier this week, I support border security. So what he calls border security, per Annie's point, a Republican operative might come out and sell as a wall. That's
and
where
for
we're
the
at.
Campaign commercials, all Trump needs is, you know, a photo op with a groundbreaking. You don't have to follow up about, you know, did you finish the wall?
Right.
And I guess it is some kind of accomplishment because, I mean, I remember during the campaign, almost nobody, certainly, you know, those of us that cover politics and you know, lots of politicians behind the scenes would admit to you, almost no one expected it would happen and laughed at the idea that a wall would be built or that it would be effective in any way. And here we are, you know, going into the second year and we're actually talking about some form of a wall. So I guess that will be interesting to watch as we move forward. Our second data point today takes us back to the Russia issue. The data point is 200. Now, that's the number of pages in a report released this week by Senate Foreign Relations Committee's top Democrat, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. And those 200 pages were in a report laying out Vladimir Putin's attack on democracy and its implications for U.S. national security. Alana, what were some of the major findings in the Cardin report and why did he choose to release it now?
Well, this is something that Cardin had been working on since pretty early last year, around the time that the Russia sanctions debate heated up. Now, this feels like years ago to Trump watchers, but remember, the president really dragged his feet on signing that Russia sanctions bill, causing a lot of political questions about why was he unwilling to get tougher on Putin. So that was kind of when Cardin got things going on this report that he just now released. And it's an exhaustive look at efforts to interfere in elections around Europe and around the world. It doesn't actually focus that much on 2016. In America. But of course, that's the subtext here. Cardin is trying to make a point to the rest of Congress saying, guys, we've got to take this seriously. It wasn't a one-off what we faced in 2016. Putin is doing this everywhere. He's getting better at it. And he's going to do it again to us in 2018 and probably 2020. So wake up.
And so, but Cardin isn't exactly a household name. And for those who might not be familiar with him, is he the kind of legislator who would throw his mother under a bus to get a Morning Joe hit? Or is he a serious lawmaker? I mean, how would you characterize him? How would you describe him?
I would characterize Ben Cardin as an old school, not necessarily like a friend to the GOP, but he's a friend to Bob Corker, who's the chairman of his committee. He's one of those old line, really intelligent, sort of deep thinking guys who, like, he will strike an Iran deal with Bob Corker that liberals will strongly dislike, even though he's a liberal. And there are a few members like that who are serious on that level left in Congress. So that Ben Cardin is doing this is Ben Cardin's version of bomb throwing, because he's sending this strong message in his own nerdy way to the rest of the members saying, guys, we've got to take election security seriously. We've got to take Russia sanctions seriously.
You almost have to take a guy like that seriously, because when I was prepping for today's show, I was naturally I hit the Almanac American Politics and was rereading his profile, and which shows his career path. He, at the age of 23, he gets elected to the state legislature. Can you imagine? Like, I was so not ready to be elected to the legislature when I was 23. And then he was Speaker of the Maryland House in his mid-30s. I mean, this is somebody who is sort
of... Fun fact, at the same time, Steny Hoyer, now whip in the House, was a really young leader in the other side of the assembly. Wow. At the same time when they were young bucks.
And that, and back then it was, if you were in leadership as a young person, you, that was really something. Like now with term limits, lots of legislatures, you know, it's not that hard to become speaker at an early age. Back then, you really had to have some game to move up in leadership. But I digress there. Annie, what is the Russia mood over at the White House now? I mean, there's new reports every day, you know, going in different directions. Trump continues to tweet about it all the time. What is the what's the vibe over there?
It's just this cloud that they can't get out from under. That's the goalpost for when it's supposed to be over keep getting pushed. Ty Cobb, the White House lawyer, started to tell Trump it would be over by Thanksgiving. Now we're into January. Now he's saying end of January. It's still going. One White House official told me that it's like a strange vibe inside the House in that no one's allowed to talk about anything. So if you are one of the players who's been interviewed by Mueller and is implicated, like Jared or Hope, your lawyers have told you don't talk to anybody. If you're an outside player like Gary Cohn or Dina Powell, who wasn't there and really is not part of this, you don't want anyone to tell you anything. So there's not a lot of hallway talk about the Russia investigation. Someone was telling me, like, on the big Flynn day, it was every office in the West Wing has a TV in it playing all day long. So it's... It's all on the TVs all day, but like no one's actually talking about it amongst themselves.
That's just like such a bizarre environment where you got it blaring on the TVs all day.
Yeah,
but
you're like not acknowledging that it's happening when you're talking to your colleagues.
Right.
At the same time, the president continues to just tout this line of no collusion. And a lot of people really do buy this argument that the campaign was really just too disorganized to even know how to collude. And it's mostly just a band of amateurs who might have gotten themselves in trouble, but collusion was above their pay grade. And the question Trump's like really obviously set on the fact that he didn't collude, but then he doesn't really talk about whether he obstructed justice or not. We don't see a lot of tweets or statements saying no obstruction of justice.
I often think that that must sound ludicrous to people who, are following this from afar, the idea that we were too stupid to collude. I mean, which is essentially the crux of their argument. But the weird
thing
is—
Like, legally, that's not much of a defense, right?
In some states, it might be. No, but I mean, that is essentially, when you boil down what they're saying. But here's the weird thing. As you know from covering the campaign, if you dealt with that campaign, it is entirely plausible that that would have happened. And
yeah.
You could ease – because it was such a Keystone Cops operation that anything was possible.
Well,
there.
If you read the Michael Wolff book, which I'm reading now, which is, take it with a multiple grains of salt. So he talks about why Don Jr. took the meeting with the Russian lawyer about adoptions. And he paints it as like Don Jr.'s just dying to bring his dad something to be like, look what I did. Give me kudos. I'm a player. Like, it's just done out of wanting to get some accolades from his father. anyway, yeah. What else was I going to say about this? Oh, I don't hear anyone, Democrats plotting for 2020 or Republicans, really expecting that the end result here is that Trump is going to leave office because he was impeached. I don't hear a lot of hope from his enemies that that's the way the story ends, or fear from his supporters that that's the end.
Well, since you brought it up, Don Jr., got to ask about him. After, in the wake of Steve Bannon talking about his treasonous behavior, he's going to crack like an egg. He seems to me to be sort of cutting a very low profile these days, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I would say that actually, he's considered I mean, he's a big instigator on Twitter. He's considered someone who really harnesses Donald Trump, the president's most aggressive, hard right policies and instincts. Like it was said that when he tweeted those anti-Muslim videos, stuff like that gets on his radar, people close to him say, because of Don Jr. flagging stuff like that for him. So he's kind of riles him up to plays into some of his more damaging instincts. We have seen him sort of maybe realize he has the upper hand with this Steve Bannon situation where we see Steve Bannon imploding and having to apologize specifically over the comments he made about Don Jr. and Don Jr. not, I don't know, yeah, playing it smart.
Yeah, boy, the bottom really fell out for Bannon in every way. But before we end this Russia segment, let me throw it to you, Ilana. I want to talk about Senator Feinstein's power move, the release of the transcript of the Judiciary Committee's interview with the founder of GPS, that is the firm behind the controversial dossier, a.k.a. the PP report, you know, the famous report at the heart of all of this. And why would she do something like that?
Well, Fusion GPS itself wanted that transcript released. Multiple Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where Feinstein is the top Democrat, wanted this transcript released. But what really, really shook this whole matter loose was Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the committee, and Lindsey Graham sending a criminal referral over Christopher Steele, who's the author of this dossier, the former British intelligence agent commissioned by the firm to compile this exhaustive, not just P-related compilation of evidence that the Kremlin might be holding something over Trump's head. So here's the chronology. Democrats have been pushing for the transcript. Fusion wants the transcript out. Then Grassley and Graham send a criminal referral to the Justice Department suggesting that Steele might have, again, this is a serious matter, run afoul of the law. And then Feinstein says, you know what? You didn't notify me you were doing that. Guess what? Here comes this transcript. I have the power to release it, so I'm going to do it. So the power move phrase is perfect for this because this is Feinstein saying, guess what? You know, I have something to say. I'm facing a Democratic primary challenge. You know, I want to reassert my liberal credentials. I care about Russia. Boom, here comes the transcript. And what was interesting to me about it, though, Charlie, is that it ended up just giving both sides reinforcing material for their own opinion about the dossier. Because Glenn Simpson, the founder of Fusion GPS, says in the transcript that that he believes there was a human source who came into the FBI to give evidence and intelligence that was similar to what Steele was coming up with. So when Steele took some of his Russia-related intel to the FBI, they were inclined to find him credible because they'd already been hearing about it.
And that human source coming from the Trump campaign?
That is what Simpson said, right? So that sounds fairly explosive, right? Like, hey, I mean, this guy, Chris Steele, was onto something. However, in other outlets, then sources close to Fusion started to say, well, all right, actually, there was an Australian diplomat who had talked to George Papadopoulos. So Simpson's assertion of a human source ended up being a little bit taken down a notch by the end of the day that Feinstein released the transcript. So this is an arcane back and forth over it. But what it really just shows is that she made this power move. It ended up giving the left and the right some good talking points on Russia and the validity of the dossier.
I also just have to say, Trump tweeted about her the next morning, calling her sneaky Dianne Feinstein, who has on numerous occasions stated that collusion has not been found, would release is under calling it underhanded what she did. This comes the day after the exchange about DACA, in which he agrees with her and sort of defends her and says, I'm on board with you. I don't know if she – then the next day he's against her. I don't know how – if what you think, how – if she lost some leverage with the president over negotiating DACA because now she's made more of an enemy out of him. I don't know.
I mean, maybe, but I think Feinstein's actually more of a secondary player in the DACA talks. It's really kind of a Dick Durbin-led initiative. I mean, her opinion matters, don't get me wrong. But I think, you know, the tweet, if anything, ended up helping Feinstein because – you know, it reminded the left that she's not actually as much of a sellout as some of them think she is if she's fighting with the president.
Yeah, I thought it was a great week for Dianne Feinstein, like the best week of the election.
Yeah, pretty much.
What more could you ask for? So she's in deep trouble at home, going to get a primary challenge because they think she has been too soft on the president. And so she gets a nickname, which is going to be great for her. Right. You know, every time he
weren't you hoping it would
Twitter.
Be like alliterative though? Trump is best with the alliterations. Well, sneaky Diane.
Sneaky's not too bad though. It's not. Not lame. It's not as good as like Little Bob or Little Marco or Low Energy Jeb, but it's still not bad. And so not only does she get a nickname from Trump, which will help her back home with the base, she also gets kudos for at least raising the issue and almost cornering him on
right.
DACA.
Right.
This is all going to be great for her.
It is a great week for
and
her.
And plus she also released the transcript, which is what lots of folks on the left wanted, which takes me to my last question for you, Ilana. This is something a friend of mine texted me this question, and I kind of had a theory about it, but I really don't know. Why didn't Republicans want this released? Like what were they afraid of? Like why not release this report or the transcript?
I think it was more useful to them for two reasons. One, for political fodder. Without the transcript in the public eye, they could make the kind of assertions about Steele and the behavior of Fusion, which keep in mind was getting paid by the DNC and Clinton folks at around this time that the dossier was written. And also, I think keeping it secret was helping them with leverage in terms of other committees who are working on Russia. There's a constant turf battle over witnesses to this day. And, you know, that transcript was a piece of gold they could use just in case, you know, the administration was dragging its feet on something. The Intelligence Committee wanted to swap info. So it was two reasons.
Our third data point this week, and you knew this one was coming, is 41.3 million. That's the number of Twitter followers Oprah Winfrey currently has. Now, for comparative purposes, Donald Trump currently has 46.4 million. Now, following Oprah's soaring hashtag MeToo speech at the 2018 Golden Globes this week, there's been a ton of speculation about her political prospects.
In my career, what I've always tried my best to do, whether on television or through film, is to say something about how men and women really behave, to say how we experience shame, how we love and how we rage, how we fail, how we retreat, persevere, and how we overcome. So I want all the girls watching here now to know that a new day is on the horizon.
Did you guys watch that speech?
I did. Yep.
And strong reactions? I mean, I have to admit, I was binge-watching Narcos, and I never watched the TV awards show, so I missed it. I had to see it the next day. Was that good?
It was a great awards show speech, yeah. And you could – I mean, I was trying – it's hard these days to watch that stuff without also looking at Twitter and immediately being affected by the commentary in real time. But it did seem like you could see her giving it as a convention speech. You could see her making a version of that. Like if Oprah ran, she'd have to outline some policies, but not in the same way that a Gillibrand or a Kamala Harris would be judged on a policy platform. She could make that speech into basically her campaign, and it would be a different kind of campaign, and it would be about big picture hope. But yeah, it felt like a political speech.
Do you feel the same way, Ilana?
I actually don't. It didn't feel political to me at all. And of course, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I'm used to listening to more of the Gillibrand style. I mean, she certainly delivered it. I agree. Like it could have been a convention speech, but it felt like something introducing nominee Kirsten Gillibrand on a platform of Me Too vis-a-vis yeah. Oprah being the candidate,
right. Actually,
you know?
My first thought listening to it, I was like, where the heck was Oprah at the DNC in 2016? Like,
yeah.
This could have been good for Hillary. Which
That's
then
a really
I
good
made
point.
Some calls and found out that they did try. They tried. She
Oof.
Wasn't interested.
Oof. Oh, interesting. Well, here's what I don't get, and maybe one of you guys can explain this to me. So the response to the speech has been so strong that people are literally want her to run for president, and which means if she does run for president, this will go down in the annals of American political history as a speech like William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold or Ronald Reagan's A Time for Choosing or Barack Obama's 2004 convention speech. What was it about the speech that made such an impact? And why would it almost immediately start a very serious conversation? Because again, no one is really dismissing this out of hand. Why would it start that discussion so quickly?
Well, I actually agree with you that I don't think she's going to run. So I don't think it will go down in history as one of those speeches. But, and I thought that the excitement was actually a sign of how in disarray the Democrats are and how there's no serious contender to be the Trump slayer in 2020 right now. And that they just are so confused. Like, do we need a celebrity candidate of our own? Or are elections about having an change elections every time, and the reaction to Trump will be a policy wonk and an experienced legislature, and Oprah is the wrong direction. So I thought that the excitement and the buzz and the not dismissing of it was sort of a sign of the desperation.
I don't disagree with any of that. To me, talking to more of the Hill Democratic crowd, there's this constant tension between do we be reactive or proactive? And I think reactive, unfortunately, is winning out right now. You hear this in the constant hand-wringing over do Democrats need their own message, their own agenda? And an Oprah-style approach, right, would ultimately be also reactive. Like, hey, you've got an influential, culturally, you know, astute billionaire, Donald Trump. We got one in Oprah Winfrey. You know, obviously, they are very different people, but the branding would almost be so similar. And I think the proactivity has got to start happening among Democrats. Somebody's got to start thinking about, like, forget about who can beat Trump. Who are Democrats?
Okay,
I'm
going to put you both on the spot. It's a lightning round question, one word answer only. No hemming and hawing. Alana, could Oprah Winfrey defeat Donald Trump if she ran against him in 2020?
No.
No? Annie?
Yes. And can I give a longer answer than one word?
Yeah, and then we'll go back to you, Alana. You'll have to explain.
I think she could, and first of all, I think that if she did run, she could emerge as the Democratic nominee. A, I think she'd clear a lot of the field. B, a way that I've heard Democratic operatives trying to position themselves for 2020 is to work backwards and say, who's going to win the South Carolina primary? Because whoever wins that, that's where the black vote coalesces around. And whoever can, you know, get out the minority vote is going to get the nomination. And Oprah, I mean, more likely than not, a black candidate over a white candidate would win the South Carolina primary and get the African-American vote behind them. And so working backwards, I think that people think, like, if Oprah ran, she'd win South Carolina, which means she'd win the nomination. There'd be a lot of excitement for her from minority voters. And I mean, if Hillary had kind of the excitement among that population that Barack Obama had, she would have won. So, yeah, there's definitely a path. I still don't think she's going to run, but I think she could win.
Alana, explain your position.
I spend a lot of time covering the quote-unquote resistance groups, right, the liberal activist groups on the left. And they are, in my view, where the energy of the Democratic base is right now. And they're craving somebody who knows the details of policy, one, and who, two, has not got so many skeletons in their closet. I mean, I saw a tweet on this, and I totally agree that, you know, the Oprah boomlet is happening. But if she really were a candidate, they would send reporters to Hawaii to dig through her property records. They would look through tapes of her show, and they would find she's promoted junk science on television. She's done a lot of stuff that liberal activists would cringe and be alienated by. And that's why I think she could not win.
Interesting. And so should we be worried about what does that mean? So say she runs. That opens a door for the next decade. It's going to be on both sides. It's going to be The Rock. It's going to be Will Smith.
Well, that
it's going
door
to be
already
like a
opened
celebrity parade.
2 years ago.
I actually think The Rock would be a better candidate, but that's a whole different segment.
Oh, he'd be an amazing candidate. Are you kidding?
Yeah. But I mean, Oprah's not opening that door. Donald Trump opened that door.
I'm not saying she's opening it, but like that would be a further step down that path, and you would you would begin to see it affect the candidate pipeline and shape it for presidential primaries. It would begin to dissuade legislators from seeing a path to the president. And, you know, maybe that's not a terrible thing given the fact that we've been so poorly served by, you know, the traditional legislators that have been running for president. And, you know, that's shown in all the polls in terms of the standing of all our political institutions. But at the same time, it's also worrisome about what it says, number one, about our nation and what drives our thinking and what about what kind of leadership we want. Is anybody else as nervous as I am about that or no?
Yeah, me. I mean, that was what the point I was trying to make about, you know, the proactivity among Democrats. They've got to find that voice. They've got to sort of end that disarray that Annie was talking about. And I'm not saying it's got to be one standard bearer, but pick somebody who can talk about the details, who's written legislation. Get back to embracing that.
Annie, before we go, I want to talk about Ivanka Trump, since she tried to get in also on this hashtag MeToo movement and piggyback on Oprah's speech and tweet support for her. And she naturally got a lot of blowback. And now I know that you, you've been covering Ivanka for a while and since the campaign and know that side of the of Trump world incredibly well. What does it say about how in touch or out of touch she is with her view of herself and her father that she would almost not even understand that she's going to get tons of blowback for seeming to jump on the Oprah bandwagon?
Yeah, I did a story on that, a quick turn story after that tweet, which just felt so out of touch. And I talked to some people who have known her a long time and some people who work with her in the White House and who said she would see absolutely – she truly sees herself as part of the feminist club. This was a quote in my story. She thinks she's devoted her life to being a champion of women, and she would see absolutely no irony whatsoever in saying, what an empowering speech, Oprah, time's up, me too. And I think it just shows how, you know, a year into her transformation from a striving Manhattan lifestyle guru to a Washington power player, she still has these major blind spots where I didn't even get pushback from the White House for the story I wrote, that basically saying this was just a misguided tweet that opened her up to so much criticism. They know, her aides know it, but she doesn't. She still thinks she can have it both ways. A year into working as an unquestioning aide for her father and not selectively commenting on accusers who she believes, and then selectively not saying anything about her, the more than a dozen women who have accused Donald Trump of sexual assault and groping. She thinks she can have this independent lane where she's judged on her own merits and not by her father. And most people don't think she can.
Well, when her father first came to office, there was this pervasive idea that Ivanka would be running the show and that she would be a moderating influence. And, you know, there are all these theories. How true did any of that turn out to be?
Not very true. She's been totally marginalized in the White House, especially since Kelly came in. I'd say that Jared and Ivanka's biggest influence, they had a lot of influence in the first half of the year, mostly on like personnel and that more than policy. They are influencers in his thinking of what they want, and he will never. But in terms of policy wins, Ilana can talk about her child tax credit, but I think it was generally seen as a very modest win.
Very modest.
And that's really all she has to show for herself on a policy side.
So as I look over these microphones at both of you guys, I think I know what your answer will be. But one of the juiciest revelations, I think, in the Wolf book was the idea that Ivanka was envisioning some sort of partnership with her husband where she would be someone who ran for president someday in the future. And so is what you're saying skepticism about the notion that she could run and win a race for president?
Intense skepticism here.
Yeah, I don't know how. I hadn't actually. That's an anecdote that was new to me from reading the book. I don't have a good sense of whether she wants that, but I would also say I'd be skeptical.
So, Ilana, we'll end that on Ivanka's potential presidential bid. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And Annie, as always, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to our listeners, our producers, Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez, our researcher, Zach Montalaro, and our illustrator, Bill Cookman. And if you like the show and want to support the Nerdcast, please subscribe, rate us, and write a review. We'll talk to you next week.